From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, people are marching across the country over the weekend in support of science. We'll talk with some people who organize Milwaukee's march.
There needs to be more visibility for the value of science, both in funding and in scientific thinking.
Then 20 years of being a female person of color in the workforce created some challenges for Mary Dowell, but it made her even more resolute.
I'm not going to pretend that it was easy. It was not. But what I will say is that I was always determined. I knew what I want. And that's what leadership is, being able to look within yourself and say, what is it that you want?
We hear from radio talk show hosts across the political spectrum on stage at a recent MilMag Live event.
And we'll visit two local shops for International Record Store Day, plus have the latest in our Bubbler Talk series.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news.
Good morning, this is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. All week we've been bringing you environmentally themed stories to celebrate Earth Week 2017. Today is the final story in the series. However, the people behind this story hope it is just the beginning. That's because tomorrow afternoon, more than 1,300 people are expected to march for science in downtown Milwaukee.
Organizers here drew inspiration from a march, also on Earth Day, in Washington, D.C. That D.C. event was put together because of concern that scientific research and its funding are at risk, both nationally and locally.
Lake Effect's Susan Bentz spoke with two Milwaukee event planners who are also setting up an organization to live beyond the march called Milwaukee Area Science Advocates.
There's more on that later, but first meet organizer Brandon Gross. The research specialist with UWM School of Freshwater Sciences explains what contributed to his love of science. He says his mom had a lot to do with it.
Luckily for me, my mother took me frequently to the Mitchell Park Domes. She took me to the lakefront and the public parks and Discovery World and Betty Brin Children Museum. I benefited from a lot of that. I grew up watching Bill Nye the Science Guy. He was a major influence for me. He's actually also a part of the National March, too. So it's really exciting to be marching alongside one of my childhood heroes. That all culminated in me being interested in science as a practice. Now the specific topic that I wanted to get into took 15 more years to figure out. I remember being a little kid and collecting toy dinosaurs, and I was obsessed with Jurassic Park, and I wanted to be a paleontologist. And then when I got into high school, I got interested in animal biology, and I entertained being a veterinarian. And once I finally went to college at University of Wisconsin, La Crosse, I fell in love with ecology, because if anyone's been to La Crosse, I mean, it's beautiful. You have the bluffs, you have the river, you have Myrick Marsh. You're just surrounded by nature all the time.
Internships and research threw Gross into intriguing projects around the country.
My field experience being on a research vessel at the University of Southern Mississippi, some of my experience studying water during my master's thesis all came together, and they recognized those abilities and gave me an opportunity to work here as a research specialist with Dr. Russell Kuhl and Dr. Carmen Aguilar, going out on a big research vessel in Lake Michigan, studying the chemistry and the biology and the ecology of the Lake Michigan ecosystem.
Brendan, did you hesitate at all in deciding to jump into this?
I didn't hesitate at all. I thought this was a cause that was long necessary. There needs to be more visibility for the value of science, both in funding and in scientific thinking. I feel that those are both under threat. And in my career of being in a bubble of science, I mean, that's really what it is. I'm surrounded by nothing, more or less people who appreciate the value of rational thought, who appreciate the value of science funding. But if you map that onto the general public, it gets turned on its head, where we have a much lower emphasis on, let's say, public policy that sticks to evidence, that we have states in this nation where they're not allowed to use the term climate change. Florida is not allowed to use the term climate change in a state building. So I see that in our country as a whole, with certain scientific endeavors, people are putting their fingers in their ears. This is the same science that makes your planes fly, that causes your microwave to heat up your soup. And yet when it tells you something you don't like, you want to ignore it. You want to condemn it. So I saw that as vital to our civilization to not put science on the back burner, to not put rational thought on the back burner. We need to highlight it because it's a foundation of democracy. If we don't have a well-informed voter base, then we don't have a well-functioning democracy. So it's not just me being self-interested and wanting to preserve my career because obviously I benefit from science funding, working in the sciences. It's that I want our next generation to have benefited from us going the direction of evidence-based policies because those are what work.
Elizabeth Ferris didn't hesitate jumping in. She's heading social media.
I got involved with the March for Science Milwaukee by kind of when I started seeing on social media the snowball effect, like from the DC March that there was going to be sister marches. I had decided to get involved. Mainly, I mean, I do care about science and I want to advocate for it, but my father is a researcher out at Dartmouth. He runs one of the chemistry labs, and he's taken, I believe, 13 trips to Antarctica to drill ice cores. And so I wanted to do this to kind of honor his work and all the research that he spent his life doing. So I got involved with the March for Science for that reason.
Another part of Ferris's motivation is her own children.
Yeah, for the boys, I believe that science being involved in our communities is going to create better communities, just even on a local basis, but obviously on a world basis too, when you're looking at climate change, when you're looking at, yeah, the temperature shifting, that trying to preserve what we have and protecting things will be better for the kids in the future because they're the ones that are going to deal with this.
You grew up in a scientific atmosphere, but do you find some people are either intimidated, frightened, if they don't have a basic understanding of science to a certain degree and the role it plays in our world?
I would say that they do. Almost kind of like an invisible wall up where they're almost telling themselves that they can't understand it, that they can't push past that. And I think this is a really good awakening for the science community to realize that wall exists and to look at how they're presenting their information to the public and putting it out there in a way that's easily absorbable. And also, I'm hoping it creates awareness for the public to look at that material and absorb it, I guess.
Yeah, one of the reasons why we have the Actual Living Scientist series on the website, and one of my personal goals, is to break down that barrier between scientists and the community. I want people to know what I'm doing. I serve the community through my research. They fund much of what we do through taxpayer money. And they are owed that information, right? So that's another good way to think about it. I agree with Beth, even from the inside, I see that sentiment about science and about scientists is that it's this intimidating thing that is very esoteric and it's all a bunch of white lab coat wearing men pouring colored liquids into beakers. Right. And it couldn't be further from that, not just in that science doesn't actually look like that, but it's also science has the potential to be a community effort. Now, we can have a conversation about what scientists have done and what the community may have done to separate and create a barrier, but we want to break it down regardless of the reasons. So it's not just a matter of reaching out to the public and saying, hey, go understand some science. We're not that arrogant. We're saying, okay, we need to speak to each other because the scientists are the community. I mean, they're just citizens. So if we can get the public talking to the scientists and the scientists talking to the public and a much better group cohesion of community, then I think we'll all benefit because it'll become less intimidating. I think it was Einstein that said if you can't explain it to a six-year-old, you don't understand it well enough yourself. So there is a failure of science communication if we're not getting the importance of certain things out to the public, that I think we're going to make a huge concerted effort towards working on with this.
On our website right now, we are publishing our own articles. We have three different series going on: The Actual Living Scientist, Science in the News, and Science in Milwaukee.
You've taken steps already to create an organization that with staying power that goes beyond the march.
Yeah, we've created the Milwaukee Area Science Advocates, public policy, science education, sustainability, and public health. So those will be our pillars.
Somebody said that it's been a long time in coming. Do you feel like this must happen now in terms of the march, in terms of the connecting and, you know?
I feel that it's very critical to do something now because the long-term irreparable effects of stripping science funding from some of the major institutions in our country will be reverberated forever. Our children's children will be reaping the consequences if we do that, as it relates to climate change, as it relates to public health, as it relates to quality air, quality water, as it relates to technological innovation, as other countries innovate and we fall behind. So every minute we're not investing, we're not publicly appreciating science and rational thought and evidence-based policy, is a second that we're falling behind and we're bearing the consequences onto our children. So I see it as something that needed to happen 20 years ago, 10 years ago, but the sooner the better.
For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Elizabeth Ferris and Brandon Gross are two of the organizers of the March for Science in Milwaukee. It's happening Saturday starting at 2 p.m. at Red Arrow Park. You can find out more about the march and the group's mission at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, we'll learn how one woman encourages everyone to harness the leader within. That story comes your way next when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. Mary J. Dowell was raised in the rolling hills of Tennessee in an all-black community, with the exception of her next-door neighbors. Many of Dowell's experiences are rooted in her childhood memory of playing with the white girl next door through the fence in the backyard. Throughout the years, that fence has become symbolic, representing barriers of racism, sexism, and more.
Dowell served several roles here in Milwaukee at Johnson Controls, Incorporated, working up to serve as Vice President of Foundation Affairs and Global Community Relations before she retired from the company 2 years ago. Today, one of her current job titles is author.
Her new book, Playing Through the Fence, is part memoir and part self-help book for emerging leaders or anyone seeking advice and inspiration on their personal and professional journeys. Along with Dowell's own story, the book includes a collection of stories from women who have persevered and triumphed over adversity.
Dowell joined me in the studio recently, and she explains how her diverse career path influenced her current career of leadership development.
I started many years ago in the medical field, where I was a nurse. I quickly changed that to go into the business field, working for large manufacturing companies in human resources. I did the corporate ladder climbing for 20-plus years. And one of the things that I noticed as I was doing this was that I noticed that people always wanted to know what resources were available to them to be good leaders, to be their maximum, optimum self. And so what I would urge them to do is, with leadership, it's a process. It takes putting one foot in front of the other. Sometimes it might feel like a slow process, but it is a process. And quite frankly, I had to remind myself of that over the years as well. So leadership development became a focus for me, and helping individuals and inspiring them to find the leader that's within each of them will always be my passion, because I have a firm belief that we all have leadership qualities within us.
You mentioned leadership and growing into your own leader is a process. And I wonder, what kind of challenges in your work life did you face that inspired many of these lessons?
20 plus years I was in the workforce, and you can imagine a female in the workforce, a person of color in the workforce, I had my share of challenges. I'm not going to pretend that it was easy. It was not. But what I will say is that I was always determined. I knew what I want. And that's what leadership is, being able to look within yourself and say, what is it that you want? Once you identify that and get the right support system, now you can move forward to become that leader. But I'm very proud that I persevered. And that's what it takes, perseverance, knowing what you want, and then having the resources to go about getting what it is you want.
The title, Playing Through the Fence, is both a metaphor, but also an actual childhood memory of yours that you're fond of, but also sends, you know, it's a situation that is both heartening and disheartening in a way. But when were you inspired to write this book, and why did you pick this as the theme?
I retired from my company that I had been with, Johnson Controls, for almost 20 years. And long before I retired, I was at lunch with a friend, and out of the clear blue, I just announced to her that I was going to write a book. And while she was congratulating me, I interrupted her and said, and I'm going to call it Playing Through the Fence. Now, what I refer to that is my moment of divine inspiration, because truly, I had never consciously thought about writing a book, let alone a title. And so with that, I did move forward to write the book. The Playing Through the Fence came from a childhood memory when I was growing up in Tennessee. And while I lived in a predominantly black neighborhood, there was one family that lived next door to us that were white. And there was a little girl who was about my age. And because of the turbulence and the racial unrest and times, we were not allowed to play in each other's yard. I was not allowed to go in her yard, but she wasn't allowed to come in my yard either. And so we had to play through the fence. It was a wire, tattered, disrepair fence. And depending on what we were playing with on a given day, depends on the holes that were in the fence. If we were playing with dolls, we need a hole big enough for a doll to fit through. If we were playing having a tea party, we only needed a small hole, just small enough for a make-believe cup of tea to fit through. But what is interesting is if you read the book, you'll find out what happened when my mom and I crossed that fence and what we found, to my amazement, once we got there.
Much like the rest of the book, Playing Through the Fence was playing with another girl your age. A lot of this book is about other females and their stories and what they have faced in their work life and personal life. So how did you select the women that you feature in this text and their lessons?
When I started writing the book, I knew that I wanted different voices. And so there are so many wonderful women in this community and beyond this community that I approached, mainly because I had such respect and high esteem for these women. But I have to tell you, too, that some of the women I've to this day have never met. These women I solicited to write a story of a time when they faced an adversity but overcame, gave me those stories. But the reason I don't know some of them is because that quest to find these women took me outside of the Milwaukee area. And I wanted to make sure that the book appealed to a broad audience. I want people to pick it up and read a story that they could say, you know, I can relate to that. That happened to me. And so it's very, very diverse, both with ethnicity and backgrounds, disabled, LGBT. I tried to make it as broad as I could. And I think I was successful in that. And the feedback I've had is that people feel that there's something relatable, even to the story of, you know, playing through the fence when I was growing up, living in the South. And men and women have said, you know, something like that happened to me. Or I had a friend that I played with but I was limited in how I could interact with that person. So it does resonate with the broad audience.
Outside of a diverse spectrum of stories, what was the one element that you thought all of these women had in common that made you want to feature them?
The one thing they all had in common was the commitment, the ability to push through and to persevere through any adversity that they had. These stories are inspirational in nature because these women pushed through. They found their leader and were successful.
Today, women are getting more predominant in the workforce, but not as fast a growth in that elite top 10% running the businesses of high management positions. But change is still moving at a slow pace. So with your experience in your career and speaking with these other women and writing this book, do you feel that gender equality is still out of reach or that we're closing the gap quicker as we move forward?
We're definitely closing the gap, but it's still very slow. What I would say is that we are working on doing that. I think we're in a time where it is more accepted. I belong to various organizations, women's organizations, such as Milwaukee Women, Inc., Temple Milwaukee, Professional Dimensions. These women groups all focus on advancing women in leadership, particularly Milwaukee Women, Inc., where we try to look at how we can get women on board. So it's more receptive. CEOs are looking at that talent pool. They're looking at women differently. Yeah, we can, you know, we can do different things. We can have families. We can raise our families, but we can also contribute to the workforce, you know, at 100% equally to our counterparts.
One key part in this book that I've found important and perhaps not all people have this element is a mentor. So to start, what is your definition of a mentor and how important is it to be mentored and in turn also to serve as one to another person?
Well, first of all, being a mentor from my perspective, you know, there are programs within our corporate America that are formalized. But for me, a mentor is someone that can help you in something that you might feel that you're maybe deficient in, someone that you can talk to, someone that you can rely on, someone who can give you advice, someone who can hold you up when you feel like you're falling down. Your family can be your mentor, someone in your church, someone at your job, your friend. You know, we mentor each other all the time. We don't think about it, but just being a good friend, when you're talking and telling that friend about something that maybe that you're feeling despair about, and that person can give you some advice that's going to lift you up and help you to move forward, that's mentoring. That's mentoring, and people don't look at it that way. Plus, what I love about mentoring is that it's a two-way street. The mentor and the mentee, you often think that the mentee is the one who's getting all of whatever is being given, but the mentor is also. It's not a time that you don't mentor someone that you don't learn something about that person. So you're gaining. I mentor all the time, many, many individuals, women and men, and I can tell you I gain so much when I mentor because I learn so much from that particular individual for that particular mentoring time. So it's a two-way street. Various people can be mentors, men, women. There are some interesting research that we did in the book that talk about the differences with men mentors and female mentors. Very distinct difference, but very good on both parts. So I would give the advice is that if you think about a mentor, don't lock yourself into thinking that it has to be something so formal. It's not. It's relaxed. It's good. It's easy. And having a mentor, too, if it's someone that you know or know of or respect or have a comfort level, because the comfort level is also important, because when that mentor gives you advice, you don't want to feel like it's negative. You want to take it, receive it, because it's good. They're helping. So you have to develop that, have a nice relationship and develop that as one of the ground rules, that you're comfortable with receiving whatever advice that is given to you.
Your book also points out that as you change as a person or as your career changes, that your relationships to your mentors or changing mentors can be a good thing. And also that it's okay to grow out of something. It's okay to say, this isn't a right fit for me, which kind of goes against the grain of what we think is you go to school, you pick a major, you do a job, and you go. So how important is a flexible mindset moving ahead in today's workforce?
Very flexible. And such a good point, because mentors do change. As you grow and develop and mature and take different directions, you know, you have different needs. And therefore, those mentors will have to change, quite frankly.
Throughout your book, there are examples of women helping other women especially. You've both mentored females and males, and you've also had various male mentors yourself. But do you think that for now, this is one crucial way that women advance professionally due to obstacles of sexism in the workplace? If there's a woman in a higher position, that she is more receptive to help out her female colleagues or to give advice to a female friend to advance each other?
Yes, women do help. You know, I believe in always reaching back and pulling someone else up. And I found that women who are in those positions predominantly are very helpful and want to pull others along. That's paramount, actually. But in absence of a female, or even if there is a female, there are mentors who are males who are very successful in helping to mentor women. So I think it goes both ways. But to your point, I think the women who are there, who are successful, do they tend to reach back and help and are receptive? Yes. I would think the predominance, definitely, yes.
How do you encourage others to find their leader, or even how to find the best professional role they were meant to have?
That's a good question. You have to really take a good, hard look. You know, when I started out, I wanted to be a nurse. There was nothing that I wanted more than to be a nurse. And I accomplished that, but life changed, and I changed. And so you have to take a look, a deep look within yourself to say what it is that I really, really want. Once you identify that, which is part of that process we talk about, once you identify that, then you can surround yourself with the resources. Now you can have a path or direction of where you want to go and how you can get there. So taking that hard look, don't just do or go and to say, I'm going to do this because it's expected of you, or people, that's what you maybe thought yourself. Be flexible in your thinking and look within frequently enough to say, is this really where I want to go? Because I have found that when you take that hard look, no matter what it is, once you decide what it is you want, you can get it. Now, it might not be a straight path. It might not be easy, but you can get it. I learned that time and time again when there were no's posed to me, and I decided yes, and I sought the resources that I need, and it was the stamina within myself, the resilience within myself, the determination, the perseverance to move forward.
Mary Dowell is the principal of MJ Dowell & Associates, and she's the author of Playing Through the Fence, stories from 19 women who challenged stereotypes, prejudice, and other barriers to achieve career success. Dowell will be speaking at the Milwaukee Business Journal Author Series on April 25th. There is more information about her and her book at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, 5 radio talk show hosts take the stage at Colectivo's back room to talk about what makes them tick. That comes your way next on Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM.
We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie Norris.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. On Monday, April 10th, the back room at Colectivo on Prospect Avenue was home to a very spirited discussion between 5 Wisconsin radio talk show hosts, 2 moderators, and the studio audience. It was the 4th in a series of community events called MilMag Live, which are produced by Milwaukee Magazine and Lake Effect. This month's topic was based on a feature story by the magazine's managing editor, Tom Tolan, called Do We Even Need Talk Radio Anymore?
Five of the hosts profiled in that story were on stage that night. Conservative hosts Dan O'Donnell and Vicki McKenna from WISN, Mike Crute and Earl Ingram from WRRD, Milwaukee's new liberal station, and conservative host Jerry Bader from WTAQ in Green Bay. Joining them were Tom Tolan and me as moderators. The following is an excerpt from the almost 2 hours of passionate and often discordant discussion. The question we asked the panel was, what is the best and worst part of your job? WTAQ's Jerry Bader spoke first.
There are a lot of people who get up every day and go, oh my God, I have to go to work. I can't even imagine that. I cannot imagine not getting up. And I have two jobs now. I work for Media Trackers, but that's actually my full-time job. I did that on the condition that I would not have to leave the radio job. I cannot imagine being the guy who used to be on the radio. I can't. I love it too much. I love the interaction, even the woman I'm feuding with on Facebook right now, who makes Michael Moore look like Ronald Reagan. You know, I enjoy doing that. The worst part of it, I don't really see a worst part. I mean, I just got rid of the annoying part, and that's the management paperwork stuff. I don't have to do that anymore. That used to be the worst part for me. I think people who have never heard my show and know exactly what I say every day, going to the stereotype, being cliched, being stereotyped, it's being judged without really being known. That'd be the biggest.
You know, I'm assuming everybody is seen or at least is familiar with the movie Almost Famous about the 1970s band. I only know that because that was the first date I went on with my wife in 2000. There's a scene at the very end where the journalist character William asks the rock star he's been sent to interview, what do you love about music? And he pauses for a moment and he says, well, to begin with, like he's going to give a canned answer, and then he says, everything. That's honestly what I feel like, whether it's conservative talk radio or sports talk radio, which I did, or spinning the hits of the 80s, 90s, and today, everything. I mean, what's not to love? We go on and we say what we believe. We talk about what we're passionate about. Like Jerry said, we can talk about fantasy football, United Airlines dragging that poor guy off of the plane this morning. I mean, anything you want. Politics is sort of the framework for it, but I really believe when you are on for 3 hours a day or 2 hours a day or whatever it is, you kind of bear a little bit of your soul for a lot of people to listen to. And that's really something special, and that bond you get with the people who listen to you and call in and email, even the ones who dislike you. It's you're putting yourself out there, and I honestly couldn't imagine doing anything else. And as for the worst thing, I don't know, maybe having to pee right before your show starts and knowing the first commercial's not for 20 minutes.
I was going to say, not being able to get up.
That's pretty much, that's honestly, that's it, though. I can't think of anything that's bad about it.
I'll tell you something.
Then again, I'm new.
Okay. I'll tell you something. I am honored every time I get an opportunity to have a microphone in my hand, because I spent 34 years in industry. And I'm a blue-collar worker. I'm a union guy. And so I lived a lifetime of walking into a plant, striking my badge, and doing my job, and people not caring what I had to say. I had a job. I did it well. I was very valuable to the company I worked for 34 years. And then after that, to have been given an opportunity where people thought that you had something of value to say, to me is beyond comprehension. So when I had the opportunity the first time, I really didn't realize the value of it. And I told people I never will forget from the first time they offered me the job. I said, I'm the guy, I'm the person I was before I got on the air. And I'll be that after it's over. And I always told the listeners that one day they're going to knock on the door and say, it's time for you to go. And I will say, thank you very much for the opportunity. And I'll hold my head up because I was the guy I was before I got there. And I'll be the same guy after it's over. And And so never did I dream in a million years, and I thank Mike for giving me the opportunity. But I come in every day and I speak for people who don't have a voice. That's my whole reality. Because there's so many people who are marginalized in the society, black and white, and who nobody's championing their causes. And so they're like any other human being. They want a fair shot at life. And I see them being taken advantage of. And with them being taken advantage of, it feels like they're taking advantage of me. So I made it clear. It's not my program. It's not my show. It's the people and the people who need a voice.
Amen, Earl. I agree with what Earl just said there. And I also feel like I'm just blessed, lucky, gifted, something that I can open up a microphone every day. And I remember I was a rock and roll morning show host when 9/11 happened. And I went riding my motorcycle around Tyrell Basin in Dane County. And as I'm looking around, I'm thinking to myself, it could go like that. There are people in this world who would take away my microphone, my free speech, everything. Could just go away like that. And I thought from that moment, every single moment was an extension on the lease, you know? So it's an absolute honor to be able to be on the radio. It's an honor to do this job. I did 42 jobs. I got fired or quit from 42 jobs. So yeah, this was something that, you know, to finally find something you love and to have somebody willing to write you a paycheck for it. The worst thing, though, is people have a tendency to oversimplify and stereotype and then dehumanize. So if they love you a lot, they can also assume that you are nothing more than just sort of a toy to be played with or a dog to be pet. And if they hate you, they want you dead under a bus. Just no in the middle there, no in between. Just it's either, let me pet you, or I want you dead and disemboweled. And that's kind of weird because I don't view people like that. So that's about the worst thing.
I have never wanted Vicky dead under a bus.
It was a dump truck.
I will tell you, I will say this. First of all, I have the advantage over these guys in that I have a co-host. And it's my 25-year best friend. And it certainly makes life a lot easier on me. Started my day at like 6:45 today at an appointment, getting life insurance for a bank. And so I could buy a radio station. And then I had to meet with an architect so I could build out a suite so I could have a radio station. So I'm going to start with what sucks. What sucks is that I felt like to continue to live my dream, what I wanted to do when I grew up, I wanted to be this guy, living the dream. The part that sucks is that Democrats, that the left, doesn't see the same value and investment in their media sources as the right does.
I agree.
And that there are a lot of bad business people. You know, you want to know why Air America failed? Bad business. You want to know why lefty radio is quote-unquote failing and why it will never succeed, according to some? Because it's full of bad business people. And as a guy who's been doing business the last 25 years, I mean, I loved working in the newsroom. I had a job back when I had hair and I was skinny. I worked for ABC. I loved that job. I loved that the youngest cub reporter could go in the newsroom and with a good idea, go pursue it and go bring back the story. And it's the greatest feeling ever. And it's instant gratification. And it's so ego fulfilling, even as a 21, 22 year old kid, that my story would play on the 10 o'clock news. It was the greatest feeling ever. And then the student loans kicked in. And I was broke. You know, I got offered an anchor job, paid $13,500 a year, full time. They owned my image. I couldn't even sell my voice for beer money. And I said, you know, I got to do something different. So for the last 20 years, I sold out my dream. My dream's to do what these guys do. My dream's to be a media guy. And I sold it out. And I did sales, and I did sales management, and I bought a company, and I poured my energies into making money. Because I thought, that's the American dream, get paid. Well, I got paid, and it's a soul-sucking experience compared to having a live red light on every day and knowing whatever you're saying, somebody's listening, good or bad. And it's the greatest feeling ever, the greatest part of this job up until election day was doing a radio show and thinking I had something clever to say. And the worst part of this job is that I have my entire life exposed right now, financially, my house, my business, every part of my life is exposed, because if it's not me, who's it gonna be? If I don't put it up, if I don't mortgage my future, there's no one on the left willing to do the same thing that think tanks and the Bradley Foundation and differing people have invested to do long before me. And I'm not a rich man by a long shot. Don't let Bruce Murphy fool you. I've never been independently wealthy. I work for a living. But this is the greatest job ever, and I have a great co-host and business partner in doing the radio show. And I admire what each one of these people do, because I go do it with a partner, and they do it alone. And if you think it's easy, it's not easy. I mean, think about how many times, just talking to the kids, your wife, whatever, you misspeak. Well, now do it on a live mic with 5,000 to 10,000 people listening. And anyways, thanks for having me on this panel. I feel like I'm not Lou Gehrig, but I do feel like the luckiest guy alive. I just wish I didn't have to invest my entire financial future to pull it off.
Well, let me real quickly say, Mike, I think, is selling himself short, because he might have thought the worst day was the election. But I think it was shortly afterwards when iHeart decided to flip formats in Madison. Now, a lesser...
Oh, we got fired the day before.
Oh, did you? Okay, the day before. I'm sorry. But the day before, a lesser person would have just said, all right, I guess my dream is dead again. But it takes a real talented human being, not a radio person, but someone to say, you know what? If an existing radio station isn't going to have my show on, I'm going to get a radio station that'll put my show on. That sort of sweat equity is the personification, I think, of what we in conservative radio talk about as really being the American dream.
Isn't Dan nice? But think about how bad you got to be. You got to buy the radio station and put yourself on.
The clinical term for that is The clinical term for that is testicular fortitude.
Mike, I always loved your show. Dom and Mike bought me beer on the air. Please, I love these guys.
That was an excerpt from the recent MillMag live event at Colectivo's back room. Milwaukee Magazine's managing editor Tom Tolan and I moderated the evening and did our best to rein in Mike Crute and Earl Ingram from WRRD, Jerry Bader from Green Bay's WTAQ, and Dan O'Donnell and Vicki McKenna from WISN.
You can find a link to Tom Tolan's original article, Do We Even Need Talk Radio Anymore?, at WUWM.com. And coming up next, we celebrate Record Shop Day by visiting two Milwaukee stores. And we'll have the latest edition in our Bulber Talk series. That's just ahead when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. April 22nd marks the 10th anniversary of Record Store Day. The idea behind it is to celebrate the unique culture that surrounds independently owned record stores, both here in the U.S. and across the globe.
The Record Store Day organization works with both independent and major labels throughout the year to create the official Record Store Day list. On that list are special vinyl and CD releases made exclusively for the day.
However, many independent stores are frustrated with a major label takeover of Record Store Day exclusives. Lake Effect's Sarah Matthews spoke with two Milwaukee record store owners about how this impacts their business.
they say it's about independent record stores, but they kind of take the independence out of it when they're telling you how to do it, what to do. You know what I mean? So it's, I'm not a big fan. And I don't want to sound ungrateful. You get a lot of business that day, but it's basically 2 weeks of business, like molded into one day. And then for the next 2 weeks, you're pretty dead. You know what I mean? So it really doesn't change anything other than, you know, other than it all happens in one day. So
that's Christopher Cruz. He's the owner of Off the Beaten Path in Milwaukee's East Side neighborhood. With an increase in major labels contributing titles to the record store day list, vinyl pressing plants are overbooked and independent labels are unable to get their releases out in time. So when customers come in on record store day looking for a certain exclusive title, it may not be in stock. While Cruz admits the day started as a way to get more business at record stores, he believes that in recent years, it's fallen short of that goal.
Yeah, we have had issues in the past, and actually this year we're not doing the titles because of it. Because the exact same thing you're speaking of is like, we'll get a few of what we ask for. We get here, people are waiting in line, they're gone within 10 minutes, and then people are disappointed the rest of the day. And that's happened, you know, more than once. So this year we decided to just not do the titles at all and just do the specials. So
Dan Duchesne and Bill Rulo are the co-owners of Rushmore Records in Milwaukee's Bayview neighborhood. They work with local bands who hope to profit from putting out exclusive record store day releases.
We get plenty of local bands that come in, and we always tell them, if you're planning on having your stuff pressed on vinyl, you need to plan way ahead, because there aren't so many pressing plants anymore. And the ones that are dominated by record store day pressings from major labels. In days gone by, you used to be able to send your master in and have a 7-inch made and shipped to you, you know, 4 to 6 weeks. Now that's, it could be 4 to 6 months because of the backlog.
They figure out the demand and the most popular titles, and if they happen to be pertaining to major label interest, they probably have more ability to push those through. You know, small independent artists, they're working on a smaller budget, and maybe their creations aren't, they're marginalized maybe because it's a smaller demand.
Duchesne and Rulo think that the real value of Record Store Day comes from the opportunity to release otherwise digital-only music in a physical form.
You look at the sales of Nevermind, a physical copy, versus a physical copy of, say, Beyonce or whatever. And often titles on the major labels aren't even available in certain formats. If you look at the R&B or hip-hop charts, it's so aggravating because you'll hear great music. It's only available as an MP3.
There's no physical entity for it. We have daily. That,
yeah, every day.
Every day someone comes to us with a great request, which we're excited ourselves to discover something we don't know. And by going through the resources, whether it's Amazon or Discogs, and you find out there's no physical entity of it, it's some type of download file share. The whole package is always important, whether to study all the people involved, the producers, the artwork, and it's always important for me to explore the music because it's just another way to get an insight on who's creating it.
Like FX Sarah Matthews with Christopher Cruz, owner of Off the Beaten Path, and Dan Duchesne and Bill Rulo, co-owners of Rushmore Records. Record Store Day is April 22nd.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Bonnie North. This week's Bubbler Talk question comes from listener Phil Lapayoker. He wants to know, where are the pigeons? When we asked him what he meant by that, he explained he's noticed a distinct lack of what some people unkindly call flying rats here in Milwaukee.
I was listening to like a podcast, and they were like talking about how, you know, animals and cities and stuff, and they ended, they're like, what color do you think a pigeon's eyes are? And I was like, I have no idea. I'll go look for one. Or like when I'm walking, I'll see one, I'm sure. And I never run into them in Milwaukee. You know, you go to other cities, even Chicago, and they're like everywhere.
Once Phil brought it to our attention, we noticed the same thing, or lack of thing, really. So I called biologist and ornithologist Dr. Peter Dunn, who teaches at UWM, and I asked him if he knew why Milwaukee is missing its pigeons.
Well, I initially thought Milwaukee is such a clean city. maybe I shouldn't say this about Chicago or New York, but my impression is that walking through those downtown areas, there's a lot more litter and, you know, food waste the pigeons would be finding attractive to feed on.
But Dunn dug a little deeper. And while it's true that Milwaukeeans tend to leave less on the ground for the pigeons to feed on, there are other reasons we don't see very many of them here. One is that there aren't so many people breeding pigeons anymore. And then there are the falcons.
There's been a huge increase in some of the predators of pigeons since the early 70s when DDT was banned. We have peregrines, 5 nesting sites of peregrines around Milwaukee now.
And the hawks.
Cooper's hawks. Those are the birds that you see around the east side quite a bit. They're just flying between houses really low and checking out bird feeders.
As everything in nature has a purpose, I wondered what ecological role that pigeons play. Dunn says they're kind of avian janitors.
They're pretty much dependent on humans. They probably feed quite a bit on seeds that are found in livestock waste, so they do have a role as cleaning up after us.
People who study pigeons point out they're not your typical bird brains, which is to say they're smart and highly evolved. So why do they have such a bad reputation? Again, I turn to Peter Dunn, who says it's a bit of familiarity breeding contempt.
They can get pretty ugly looking when they're hanging around in the trash and see some that have their feathers all matted because they've gotten garbage stuck in their feathers and they haven't cleaned it off.
Dodging their droppings doesn't endear them to us either. Well, I got back in touch with Phil Lapayoker to let him know he was right.
All right, thank God.
He was surprised to learn that the reason he wasn't seeing pigeons was because of the citywide increase in hawks and falcons.
Wow, that's like a cool cause and effect kind of thing going on there. Most importantly, I'm not crazy, at least as far as pigeons are concerned. They gross me out still, but that's very interesting.
So what was Phil going to tell his friends?
That I'm right. That's what I'm going to say. I'm not even going to explain it. I'm just going to say I'm right. It's on the radio, and it's official.
Bubbler Talk is a production of WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio and made possible by the Board Game Barrister, satisfying Milwaukee's thirst for fun with games, classic toys, and puzzles for all ages. Locations at Bayshore, Greenfield, South Milwaukee, and now Mayfair. Do you have a question about Milwaukee you want answered? Submit it to us at WUWM.com, and maybe we'll quench your thirst for knowledge.
And that's all for Friday's edition of the show. Thank you for listening. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. Audrey and I produce the show along with Joy Powers and Vince Tyke. We get additional production from Mayon Silver and Sarah Matthews, and reporting from Susan Bentz and Rachel Morello.
Michelle Maternowski helps us with web and social media, and John Strelucky is our studio engineer. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
We'll be back tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock now, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next. 'Cause it's you and I knew that you knew you were stuck.